It's globalization, stupid. And what happens when you try to unravel it? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In New York, I'm Lizzie O'Leary, in for Kai Rizdahl, who is on assignment. It is Wednesday, January 4th. Good to have you with us. We are starting with a few words from the Federal Reserve. Today, they told us they might have to start raising interest rates faster than they had initially planned if the unemployment rate drops below 4.5% and starts to spark inflation. It's now 4.6%. That news comes from the minutes of the Fed's meeting back in December. Fed officials also said it was too early to know what President-elect Donald Trump's fiscal policy would be and how it might affect the economy. Now we're going to turn from the U.S. economy to Europe's, where Britain's ambassador to the European Union has quit. Ivan Rogers was supposed to be one of the people working on the Brexit. Instead, he took a swipe at the British government in his resignation letter. He accused it of muddled thinking about how to leave the EU. Turns out, promises made to populist voters can be hard to keep, both in Britain and here at home. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer has that story.
So, you promised angry voters the moon. Now that you're in office, you have to deliver. In Britain, it's time for a reality check. Michelle Egan is a global fellow at the Wilson Center. She says Britain may have to negotiate more than 100 new trade agreements, and it can't finalize any of those new agreements until its messy Brexit divorce is final, because
nobody wants to negotiate with somebody who's in the middle of a divorce proceedings.
Brexit will be much harder than, say, a U.S. divorce from NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement.
I mean, it's the equivalent of trying to get out of a handshake versus trying to sever a limb.
That's Rachel Brewster. She's a professor of law at Duke University. She says it still could be challenging to renegotiate NAFTA because Mexico and Canada may not want what we want. She says Canada may focus on trade disputes.
We have lots of cattle disputes with them. So my guess is that they probably want to clear those things up.
And unraveling NAFTA, just like negotiating Brexit, is complex, says Scheherazade Rahman. She's a professor of international finance at George Washington University.
The United States, you know, negotiated a deal based on very specific legal issues and precedences.
Those issues would have to be renegotiated. And in many cases, President-elect Trump would need congressional approval to increase tariffs or taxes on imports. And that's not a done deal, even in a Republican-controlled Congress. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Rex Tillerson cut a deal to cash out. The former ExxonMobil head and the Trump administration's choice for Secretary of State will convert 2 million deferred shares of Exxon stock in his retirement package to cash. They're worth roughly $182 million and will go into an independently managed trust. If confirmed, he would also sell the 600,000 Exxon shares he currently owns. Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein looks at whether this agreement will satisfy the Senate.
After more than four decades with ExxonMobil, Rex Tillerson was looking to a nice retirement, a nine-figure golden parachute. The company's plan called for Tillerson to get a chunk of his 2 million stock shares every year for a decade. Then, President-elect Donald Trump tapped him to be Secretary of State. So, some kind of deal had to be worked out, says University of Delaware's Charles Elson.
This is an odd one. Typically, CEOs don't retire to become Secretary of State.
Tillerson could end up addressing climate change or sanction Russia, work that could influence the value of Exxon stock. So in an effort to avoid any conflicts, Exxon has agreed to give him the value of those 2 million shares, which will be placed in a trust and distributed over the next decade. Ultimately, Tillerson would forfeit about $7 million if confirmed.
Rex Tillerson is going to leave a lot of money on the table at ExxonMobil in order to take this job.
That's Richard Painter, a former ethics lawyer for George W. Bush. Painter says with this divestment, Tillerson's following the executive branch conflict of interest playbook.
Most people are willing to invest only in conflict-free assets, municipal bonds, U.S. Treasury securities, mutual funds. There are a wide range of options you can choose from.
We don't know exactly how Tillerson's money will be invested, but Painter says his case is easier than other Trump nominees who own private assets that are harder to sell than ExxonMobil stock. The question, says Painter, is whether Donald Trump will follow the lead of his own cabinet nominee. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
If you are tired of hearing about California's drought, well, tough. Here's why. It's the sixth largest economy in the world and grows a ton of America's produce. The good news is that California has gotten a lot of rain in the past few months. The bad news is rain's okay, but it's not what they really need. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Jed Kim reports.
Talking weather in California requires perspective. There's now and there's later. Now?
We've had plenty of rainfall, especially in the northern Sierra, but not much snow.
Dave Rosardo is chief of the snow survey section for the California Department of Water Resources. Snow is critical for it later. It melts in the spring, providing a third of the state's water supply. Now, snow levels are below historical averages. Storms later this week could push the levels up above those averages. But Rosardo says it's still early in the season.
We do need to then continue the trend of having sustained storms throughout the winter.
To get out of drought conditions, the state needs years of above-average snowfall. Still, Daniel Sumner, who teaches agricultural economics at UC Davis, says the amount of rain and snow has helped.
So far, at least, things are close enough to normal that farmers aren't going to make drastic changes in either their planting decisions or their irrigation decisions.
Remember, California is the largest food producer in the U.S. Sumner says grass is plentiful enough right now that things look good for young cattle, especially if the rest of winter is wet. For dairy and tree nut farmers, though, revenue doesn't look great regardless of water supply. Prices for those have dropped. Still, a wet year would help replenish overdrawn groundwater.
What that does is give us a little cushion in terms of planning for long-term changes.
Like the warming planet, which will mean less snow. A future that may be coming sooner rather than later. I'm Jed Kim for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, partly sunny. Details when we do the numbers. Right now in Las Vegas, about 170,000 people are converging for CES. That's the big yearly electronics and tech show where some 400,000 companies show off new stuff, tech people network, and journalists try to figure out what you're actually going to use in the future. Our own senior tech correspondent Molly Wood is there. Hi, Molly.
Hey, Lizzie. How are you?
I am good. Tell us about why CES matters now. I mean, who's even there?
Well, it turns out a lot of people, especially judging from the cab lines. CES, it used to be called the Consumer Electronics Show. Now it's just plain CES. And increasingly, it's a show where people come to not just look at what is going to be the big tech trend for the coming year, but also make deals. It's a big media show. There are a lot of international attendees. Even the companies that don't officially exhibit, like Amazon and Apple and Google, have some sort of presence here. And there are so many startups that even venture capitalists are starting to come.
Well, and this has also led to kind of larger conversations than just on the consumer front. I mean, about policy and the change of presidential administrations.
Yeah, that is really a big layer over this year's show in particular. The Consumer Technology Association is the nonprofit trade group that puts on CES, and it is fundamentally a lobbying group. They're based in Washington. They lobby on behalf of the tech industry. They try to promote innovation, you know, as a business trade association, but also as a political arm. And so the questions of policy that are raised by an incoming administration are huge. The FCC is always a big topic of conversation here. I talked to Gary Shapiro. He's the CEO of the CTA. And he said that, you know, the tech industry is feeling positive about some things. Obviously, everybody feels excited about investment in infrastructure. You can imagine the tech industry is going to push for tech-based infrastructure investment. The change in the corporate tax rate, some sort of positive immigration changes potentially. But he said that there are also worries.
We're concerned about the discussion of trade. Companies build here, or it'll be, oh, if you import products, we're going to charge consumers a lot more money to go shop at Walmart. So we have some concerns, but we will engage in a dialogue.
The star of CES, Lizzie, is always the Internet of Things, and that is predicated really on a huge flow of inexpensive technology, mainly from China. That, you know, they're talking about a $1 trillion industry that depends on cheap electronics. So the trade question, I think, in particular, is really top of mind.
You mentioned the Internet of Things. I have been in some of our conversations a little skeptical of this.
Yeah.
So is it like ready for prime time now? And what besides that is being exhibited this year.
The smart home is basically the biggest trend, I think, at the show this year. We're already seeing some sort of interesting announcements. Today, Amazon announced that it's going to put Alexa into an LG refrigerator.
Wow.
Those are the kinds of trends that I think are actually going to make the smart home usable, because it really comes down to voice. A survey came out just today. Coldwell Banker and Vivint, which is the home security product, 72% of Americans who have smart home products want voice control, because that is the only way to make this stuff work. I am also a skeptic, Lizzie. I think for most people, it's still a little too complicated, but we're getting closer.
Marketplace's Molly Wood, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
And since this is the first Wednesday of the new year, that means we've got an episode of our podcast, Corner Office. You can subscribe today if you haven't already. This time, a favorite of ours from the year gone by. An interview with the CEO of Moog Music, the company behind the very well-known Moog synthesizers. It's a good one. Check out Corner Office from Marketplace, wherever you get your podcasts. Molly Wood talk about trade just then and how it affects tech. Global trade has not gotten a lot of love from the incoming administration, especially the Trans-Pacific Partnership, or TPP, which would have linked 12 Pacific nations, including the U.S. and Japan. President-elect Donald Trump called it a disaster. Meanwhile, China, which was not part of the TPP, is pushing ahead with its own trade deal. It's called the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership. Marketplace's Adam Allington breaks it down for us.
The TPP covered nearly 40% of the global economy. But as President Obama put it, the deal was never just about trade.
If America doesn't shape the rules of the global economy today to benefit our workers, while our economy is in a position of new global strength, then China will write those rules.
The pact's failure could also mean U.S. exports will miss out on preferred access to countries like India, China, and Japan.
Yeah, in fact, that's already happening to us.
Jason Halfmeister is the associate administrator of USDA's Foreign Agricultural Service. He says the TPP would have cut tariffs across a range of products, from beef to wine. Without it, those tariffs remain, and the doors left open for China to increase its influence. In fact, China's regional trade bloc, the RCEP, is already under consideration by 16 countries in the Pacific region.
These countries of great interest to us will be opening their markets to some of our competitors, and we'll fall behind.
U.S. agriculture stood to be a big winner under the TPP, particularly for exports to Japan, the world's third largest economy.
This is the picking line. The peanuts come here, and then they have hand pickers.
Paul Rogers is a third-generation Virginia peanut farmer. The TPP, he says, would have increased the export market considerably, eliminating tariffs and quotas in key countries.
And it would also put us on a little more level playing field with China and India, who are our two biggest competitors in that part of the world. I think China is going to sweeten the deal, and we're going to be on the outside looking in.
RCEP, like TPP, aims to boost trade, but many economists say RCEP is more limited in scope. Linda Lim, a professor at the University of Michigan, says the TPP went far beyond tariffs, actually changing the rules for doing business in the region.
Labor and environmental standards, stronger intellectual property rights, coverage of services as well as of goods, and so on.
But critics say the TPP would have cost jobs in some countries and weakened labor and environmental standards in others. Economics aside, some fear the biggest loss for the U.S. is diplomatic. In backing out of the TPP, they say the United States has abandoned its position as a global champion of free markets. That's the view of Jacob Kierkegaard of the Rhodium Group.
The United States, for the first time since World War II, has walked away from a major liberalizing regional trade initiative.
President-elect Trump says he's interested in pursuing more bilateral trade deals. He also says he'll renegotiate the North American Free Trade Agreement and label China a currency manipulator, all of which means the TPP is not the only cloud on the free trade horizon. In Washington, I'm Adam Allington for Marketplace.
Coming up.
This is a simplified way of putting it, but you're essentially clipping it together like a kit.
In the future, construction might look a lot like Lincoln Logs. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average added 60 points, 0.3%, to land 19,942. The NASDAQ advanced 47 points, 0.8%, to end at 5,477. And the S&P 500 gained 12 points, just over 0.5%, finishing at 2,270. Rental car companies have been taking heat from the rise of rideshare services. Today, Hertz Global Holdings got a boost of confidence when investor Gamco Asset Management increased its stake in the company to 5%. That sent Hertz shares driving up just under 5%. And Weight Watchers stock price has been yo-yoing. In December, its shares rose after major shareholder Oprah Winfrey announced she'd lost weight. The price settled back, but last night, Oprah told Stephen Colbert she'd shed 40 pounds, and today, shares soared 20%. Bonds rose slightly. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.43%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Hey, everybody. Molly here.
It's Kai, but you already knew that.
You did. But we have something that we would like to tell you together.
We are doing a new podcast. It's called Make Me Smart, about the things we want to know more about but don't always have time to dig into on this daily program.
Yeah, and it's about you, too, the things that you want to know more about and the things that you're an expert on. We'd like to have you on the show, too.
And mostly it's me and Molly having fun. Check us out at marketplace.org/makemesmart. There's lots more info there.
And please subscribe on iTunes or wherever you podcast.
This is Marketplace. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. If you've used an app to take public transit, get the keys to a shared car, or hail a ride, you're getting a taste of what's called the mobility revolution. Basically, the new services and products that help you get around without a car. What's revolutionary, though, isn't just the changes to how we travel, but also what this means for the environment, different companies and industries. And yeah, it's happening pretty quickly in America, but parts of Europe have gone further. Marketplace's Mark Garrison reports from Berlin.
When I open the Moovil app, I see my current
position. Mary Oswald works for the German company Moovil. She says the kind of things you expect to hear from someone at a tech company focused on transportation services and apps.
We really believe that public transit is the backbone of every city's mobility infrastructure.
The Moovil app also connects to the car-sharing service Car2Go and a ride-hailing service called MyTaxi. Many of these are increasingly available in the U.S. and elsewhere in Europe. The Moovil worldview says transportation must be convenient and green.
Nowadays, the necessity to own a car, I think it's not present like it was in the past years.
Also on message, unless you happen to know Moovil's owner, Daimler, parent company of Mercedes-Benz. Take that in for a minute. This is the German car company, tracing its history all the way back to Carl Benz, credited with inventing the gas-powered automobile back in the 19th century. It has a whole division steering people toward a future with fewer cars on the road.
So we could use, for example, public transit. We might use a Car2Go.
I continue the conversation with Oswald on the sidewalk, asking her to get me directions to my hotel. Moovil's app recommends we head down to the subway, Berlin's U-Bahn.
Daimler has been evolving really beyond being just an automobile manufacturer into really a network mobility provider.
Daimler, BMW, and Volkswagen are all talking like this now, and to different degrees, launching new businesses and investing in startups.
This is our stop, so let's get off.
And it's not just in Europe. Back up on the street, I ask her to punch another destination into the app.
Okay, so can you try typing in Portland, Oregon?
Unfortunately, there are no connections available.
Which is fine, because I can just call them up. Portland is where Moovil's North American headquarters is. Their CEO, Nat Parker, is eager to explain how Moovil makes it possible to buy public transit tickets on smartphones.
So I'll get us a couple 2.5-hour tickets.
Parker definitely didn't start out as a Daimler guy. He came into the fold when the German automaker bought his startup, which focuses on public transit. Back at the office, he tells me about when his new boss paid a visit to Portland. He's a Daimler veteran who drives a screaming fast Mercedes sports car, and he wanted Parker to give him a ride.
Then I said, well, I can, but I've been trying to hide from you the fact that I have a car you wouldn't like. And so I introduced Jörg to Sheila, my 1999 Subaru station wagon. Jörg bent over laughing at the vehicle. She has many a dent. She sputters a bit when you drive her. But I said, look, I'm the face of the new Daimler customer.
He's part of a rising generation that doesn't seem to care as much whether they own a car as long as they get to where they want to go. This worries Germany's automakers, but they're hopeful they can still make money off these folks by selling them access to car sharing and ride hailing, ideally in cars they manufacture. Daimler also sells mobile ticketing software to public transit agencies and earns commissions on ticket sales. These new mobility businesses also offer the possibility of positive environmental impact.
The reduction in people sitting one butt to a chair in one car, it's really going to have a huge impact, not just on greenhouse gas emissions, but also on some of the core makeup of our cities.
That means a potential image boost for an industry sometimes seen as environmentally suspect or even outright scandalous in the case of VW and its emissions cheating. These mobility services are very new, so it's not yet clear what the environmental impact will be or whether the perceived millennial skepticism about car ownership is real and lasting. Car companies aren't quite sure, which is why they're putting hundreds of millions into these new mobility ventures. That sounds like a lot, but Daimler alone did nearly 150 billion euros in 2015 overall revenue. So it and the competition are investing way outside their historical comfort zone. In Berlin, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
From how we move to how we build. Can you imagine a skyscraper made of wood? This is not a relic of earlier centuries, but in fact a very modern way of thinking about construction, using something called CLT, or cross-laminated timber. Justin Davidson wrote about it for New York Magazine, and we brought him in. Justin, how exactly does this work?
Yeah, so it's really about taking relatively small units of wood when they're sawn boards, but you're then gluing them together into these massive units. So the general term for this is mass timber. Mass timber has two basic components. One is CLT, cross-laminated timber, which is these huge boards, essentially, made up of smaller boards.
How big are we talking about?
They could be 8 to 12 inches thick.
Oh, wow.
So that's a thick piece of super plywood, 10 feet wide, 40 feet long. So one of those would give you a lane of a bowling alley.
And so you take those and then you use the phrase in here almost like a really kind of high-tech Amish barn raising.
The great advantage to it is that you can manipulate it in a factory using computer-controlled milling and do all the openings that you need, cut out the windows, cut out channels, and pre-design and then pre-manufacture these units that can then be quickly assembled on site. This is a simplified way of putting it, but you're essentially clipping it together like a kit.
You came here to our office on, 3rd Avenue in New York City, walking through like a canyon of steel and glass buildings. Why build out of wood when you could do it that way?
So one reason is environmental. So essentially, for a ton of steel, you're producing something like a ton and a half of carbon. For a ton of wood, you're warehousing carbon. So the difference in carbon emissions is actually much bigger.
And the cutting down of trees?
You're not cutting old growth forest. You're not deforesting the Amazon. These are managed forests. So you're planting the trees, you're letting them grow 10, 15 years, and then you you harvest them. And actually, one theory is that essentially this is self-sustaining and self-capitalizing, because if there's a demand for construction-grade wood in the United States and in Europe and around the world, what you're doing is pumping money into the forestry business.
One thing that immediately jumps into my mind, and you mentioned this in your piece, is there was a time in America, certainly around the turn of the century, where we built everything out of wood, and cities like San Francisco went up in flames.
So if you think about making a fire in your fireplace, you don't put a great big log on the fireplace and then hold a match to it. What you do is you build up the fire using smaller kindling. So essentially, CLT is like that big log. It will burn, as will every other material, but it will burn slowly and in a predictable way, essentially giving residents time to escape and firefighters time to respond. And they've done a lot of tests with this. I mean, this is a well-tested material.
Tested for earthquakes as well.
Tested for earthquakes. It has a fire resistance that's equivalent to concrete and steel.
What's the biggest barrier to this becoming widespread?
Habit. I mean, the construction industry is very routinized. So when you're talking about changing the way you do it, there's a startup cost that's significant. But you also have to kind of vertically integrate the whole thing so that you are bringing the logs or the boards into a manufacturing center that is going to put in raw lumber in one end, maybe even just like tree trunks, and produce building components out the other.
Justin Davidson, architecture critic for New York Magazine, thank you so much.
It's been a pleasure.
This final note before we go, we now have the name of President-elect Trump's pick to head the Securities and Exchange Commission. He's chosen Jay Clayton, a lawyer who's represented many big banks on Wall Street, including Goldman Sachs and Barclays. The SEC's purview includes enforcing rules for securities firms and may play a role in Trump's stated plan to dismantle the Dodd-Frank financial regulatory law that was put into place after the 2008 financial crisis. The Trump team put out a statement today saying they want to, quote, undo many regulations which have stifled investment in American businesses. That is all for us. Today, the Dow added 60 points, 0.3%, to land at 19,942. The Nasdaq advanced 47 points, 0.8%, to end at 5,477. And the S&P 500 gained 12 points, just over 0.5%, finishing at 2,270. Chris Clark, Brad Fisher, Jake Gorski, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday engineer the show for us. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. See you tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.